listening to They Came From the North, your weekly dose of director spotlights and belligerent Canadians and four people basically, you know, bickering and whining amongst themselves about what we like and dislike about a particular director's body of work. With me, I've got a cross-section of Canadiana from the misty realm of the wooded east. I've got Mr. John Mercer.
Hey!
From the slightly less misty and less wooded, but still pretty picturesque Quebec, I've got Gabriel Girard.
Bonjour!
And from the flat as hell, except for in the Rockies West, that's probably right nice and bright and sunny, I've got Andrew Forbes.
Present.
And accounted for?
Well, present.
Very good.
I don't know. If you've accounted for me, all the better.
I account for no one.
Oh.
I am Steve. I am your host this week. We'll get things started the way we usually do. We'll talk a little briefly about something we might have seen in the last short amount of time since last we spoke that might be worth sharing with each other. We'll start with you, Gabriel.
I saw a movie called Lolila, which was directed by Jenna Fisher and written by her with uncredited written work by James Gunn, director of Slither and Super. It's a fake documentary about artists like this actor and this actress who decide to do good work and help the homeless by distributing lollipops with art on them. It's basically a critique of these shallow people that do good work just to be about themselves, and it's an examination of a couple really too. It was shot for about $2,000 and distributed by Trauma Film. It's a very funny movie, very unusual for Trauma. There's no gore, there's no boobs, there's no slapstick. It's just very, very funny.
Sounds pretty high budget.
Spontaneous reaction. I have never heard that description before.
My experience with Trauma pretty much begins and ends with Toxic Avenger and Sergeant Kabuki Man. So.
it is not a typical Trauma film at all.
That's a very good thing.
James Gunn started by working on Romeo and Juliet, and I'm guessing Lloyd Kaufman distributed the movie as a favor for Gunn directing Romeo and Juliet and not getting credited.
Right on. How about you, Andrew?
Well, I watched Redline, which is a 2009 anime, sort of sci-fi intergalactic racing. Well, I should say not intergalactic racing, racing that happens to take place between many worlds on the ground. It's car racing, but, you know, all kinds of weird souped up sci-fi vehicles.
It's the pod race.
It's F-Zero, the movie.
Very much so.
It's the pod race.
It's kind of the pod race if that movie didn't blow.
even instead of Jake, was Jake Lloyd?
Yeah.
Young Anakin had been played by Fan Elvis.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's got this massive pompadoured main character who drives a souped up sort of sci-fi-ified Trans Am. And I mean, the gist of there's some sort of dramatic twists and turns involving his strange relationship with his manager and maybe some double dealing and tie ups with the mob. But sort of the main action of it is this big sort of the ultimate race of the year on Robo World, which is a totalitarian cybernetic world that is very hostile to the idea of having these racers. And it ends up being a crazy kind of mix of it's very comic, but it's also sort of genuinely exciting. The animation is fantastic. It's just like the kineticism of the racing is captured perfectly. But it even manages to sort of throw in some giant monster fighting and pretty much anything you could hope for in just a straight up fun movie.
I saw it about, a little while ago now, maybe, I won't say 2 years ago, but maybe a year and a half ago or so. I watched the subtitled version. Did you find, I kind of did, but did you find it was a little bit Ralph Bakshi-esque?
I think I sort of know what you mean by that.
Just the style and, you know, like the kind of the hillbilly main character and the racing.
I don't know. Like, throwing in sort of deliberately strange characters.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Lots of sort of deliberate references to certain eras of American pop culture and Japanese pop culture and things. Yeah, but I mean, by contrast, it's good.
I will bet you that the director of that listened to like untold amounts of Guitar Wolf when he was making that movie.
Yeah, it's rad.
I thought it was a pretty cool flick. I did really enjoy it. How about you, John?
Well, I went to the theater with my wife last week.
Oh God.
And this doesn't end well. It never does.
No.
No. And I had the distinct displeasure of seeing American Reunion.
Oh.
And all the goodwill that Sean William Scott earned, in my opinion, with his absolute brilliant performance in Goon.
Goon was amazing. Goon was absolutely incredible, yeah.
Yeah, well, that just gets flushed straight down the shitter.
That makes me sad.
And it felt like a movie that was not just a product of its times, but completely trapped by them now.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah, it was just it was absolutely terrible. So then I came home and just wouldn't go to bed and cry myself to sleep. I sat down and watched Tombstone.
Mustaches all around. I think they should call that movie The Mustache Parade.
Y'all a bunch of goddamn pimps.
Turn your head into a canoe.
And that's still one of the greatest movie threats ever.
Turning someone's head into a canoe?
Yeah.
I got to agree with that one, yeah.
That movie is mustaches and uttering threats.
Yeah.
You're going to do something or you're going to sit there and bleed? You know, I'm going to cut your goddamn pimp's heart out.
I'm coming.
Oh, man,
tell
you don't
him
step
I'm coming.
Aside. I swear to God, we're going to tear you apart.
You tell him I'm coming, and hell's coming with me.
Stephen Lang is so sketchy in that movie. Like, the last time I watched it was right after I'd seen Avatar, and I liked Stephen Lang in Avatar.
I thought he was the best part of the movie.
Yeah, like he was obviously having a great old time being like the ultimate like mustache twirling villain. But then, I mean, you watch Tombstone and he's just the slimy coward and it's like, where's the badass? Which is so strange to me to now think of Stephen Lang as a badass, because prior to Avatar, that was certainly not how I thought of him.
He was probably the coolest character in Public Enemies as well.
Did you guys ever see a movie he made in the mid to late 80s called Band of the Hand?
Nope.
It's on Netflix Canada.
I do love titles that rhyme.
Well, it was actually made by Michael Mann in between Miami Vice and Crime Story. And it was supposed to be, you know, the pilot for a television show. And they actually thought they had something, so they released it theatrically.
But called it Band of the Hand.
Yeah, and what it's about is it's kind of like 21 Jump Street if it was badass. You know, you got a bunch of troubled like gangbangers and everything. And
I did hear about this.
Yeah, instead of being sent to graduating from juvie to real prison, they're basically given to a former leader of a Marine Corps fire team, and he kind of. He basically starts teaching them self-respect, and once they realize how bad crime has gotten into the neighborhood, then he decides to train them as a paramilitary strike force.
I'd love to see a new series where Richard Grieco, at his current career state, is taught self-respect.
I saw Jump Street last week, man. I was holding out for that Richard Grieco cameo that never came.
What?
You know, they pretty much had a cameo from everyone from the original series except the Vietnamese kid, and there was no Richard Grieco.
Johnny Depp was in there?
Johnny Depp was in there. Johnny Depp was hilarious in it.
All right, on.
Yeah, because he gets up and just he's giving his big speech, he gets shot in the throat.
Nice.
Like Samuel Jackson in Deep Blue Sea.
No, no, but that doesn't mean you should rush out and see 21 Jump Street.
No, I won't be, don't worry. Mine this week was actually, it was something I discovered a while ago. I discovered it actually on an episode of the British Top Gear, but found it on US Netflix and decided to give it a go. It's a movie directed, a documentary directed by Eric Bana called Love the Beast.
Oh, I've heard of that.
It was amazing. Absolutely incredible. Not a car movie, not one of these, you know, like it's not talking about horsepowers and what year this and, oh, in this year model they changed this or, you know, like it doesn't get into the nitty-gritty of cars or car culture. And it doesn't present, you know, the stereotypical gearhead, the car freaks who, you know, polish off their 71 Challenger and go to a car show every weekend. Like, it's about people who just develop a love for the machine they drive. And not in a sense of, you know, like, oh, I'm restoring this car and I'm, you know, this, that, and the other thing. Like, yes, it is about it's Bana's first car and what he did with it. It was a 74 Ford Falcon. It was the same car that was in Mad Max.
Oh, nice.
And, of course, Bana being Australian, he bought the car when he was 15 in 77. And he and three of his buddies, the guys who came up with him together, all basically maintained it, kept it running, put replacement parts and stuff in it. And over the years, they all got back together, like, even after, you know, the celebrity hit. Because Bana was pretty late to the celebrity game. He was already married. He'd had a kid, you know, and all this kind of stuff when Hollywood came calling. And even after all of this, he goes home, and it's just right back to his garage with his buddies. And they took his 74 Falcon, rebuilt it, and entered it into Targa Tasmania, and him and one of his close buddies drove it in the Targa race. And
nice.
It was such a just an emotional piece of film, you know? And it, like, for someone, like, I mean, yeah, I am a car guy. I'm into car culture. Like, you know, I'm pretty well-versed in cars. So for me, it was like, you know, I've had cars that I felt that way about. I mean, like, my first car was a shitty 1988 Plymouth Reliant station wagon, but I love that car, you know? I had so many good times in that car, and I linked that car to so much of my youth and even my early adulthood. And, you know, it gets into that whole feeling about how, like, a person's life can kind of center around a vehicle that they have a particular attachment to and that sort of thing. But, of course, it's also, you know, you've got guys like Jeremy Clarkson from Top Gear, Jay Leno, Dr. Phil.
Oh, is in there. You lost me with Leno.
Man, the thing about Leno, and like, I've seen it before. I was actually on his website, Jay's Garage, a few years ago. And you really see it in this documentary. What Leno does, like, in front of a camera is not his passion. His talk shows, his stand-up, none of this is Leno's passion. But you get Leno started on cars, and you see that twinkle in his eye. He becomes a human being, you know? But it was such an emotional, really, really well-put-together documentary. And, I mean, there's one scene in particular in it. I won't spoil anything, but it was heart-wrenching. You know, it was just such a brutal, brutal scene. And, I mean, especially someone with kids, the way it's cut together and the way they use it, it was kind of manipulative, but at the same time, man, it got me. It sucker-punched me, you know? But just by the end of it, I was completely enthralled with that movie. When it was over, I just wanted to go back and I wanted to watch it again. It was great.
I will have to pick that up.
It's well worth a look-see. Well worth. Moving on, we will get to the core of our show, the reason we've all gathered here this evening. Tonight, we'll be discussing American filmmaker Kevin Reynolds. He got his start in the early 80s. He released his first feature, a movie called Fandango, in, I believe it was 85?
Sounds right.
It was.
After that, he moved on to a few lesser-known roles before he really hit big in 1991 with his friend and compadre up to that point, Kevin Costner, in Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. His personal life, he's a born and bred Texan. He's a little bit of a cowboy. You know, he's an outdoorsy, rugged type. His movies generally kind of sway towards testosterone-driven, but he does show a little bit of depth in there. He does show the occasional, you know, heartfelt kind of story. You know, you've got Rapa Nui's in there, you've got 187. He hasn't got a huge body of work, but what's there is pretty quality. And we'll get the ball rolling. We'll start with Gabriel. Gabriel, what was your good pick for Kevin Reynolds?
My good pick is The Beast of War, also known as The Beast, which takes place during the communist invasion of Afghanistan. It centers on a group of Russian soldiers driving a huge tank who get embroiled with the Mujahideen and the fighting that ensues and the various conflicts. It's a very gripping movie that gets you in it right at the beginning with a very shocking scene of a Mujahideen getting rolled on by the tank, which you would never expect in a mainstream movie. I mean, it really shocked me to see it with such brutality. The characters are very layered. The actors are great. The action is great. It's such a perfect, non-conventional war movie.
It was a movie I'd been hearing about for a while, and I actually went to pretty extensive lengths to track it down. I wound up ordering it online and paying about $40 for a copy on DVD. But I gotta say,
what happened a week later?
A week later, it turned up in every Walmart bin in the country for $5.88. But it's one I enjoy as well. It's one that opening sequence, man, that opening attack on the Mujahideen village is just so beautifully shot.
It has me right from the opening. The Rudyard Kipling quote.
Yeah, yeah.
Right about, you know, go to your God as a soldier.
Yeah.
It's got me right from there.
It's really got that kind of boy's own feel too. You know, it's got that.
Another. I know we were talking about this a few episodes ago. It's another one of those ones where you're sitting there, going, "How did Hollywood miss out? Like, why isn't Jason Patrick as big as Tom Cruise?"
He definitely had his day.
Yeah. No, but I mean, it's just like he had a string of high profile hits, man, back in the late '80s.
Yeah. Yeah.
How about you? I don't know. I mean, it might be partly, speaking of Jason Patrick's career arc, I think he might have sort of made the deliberate choice to try to find some more interesting roles. The times when he has deliberately tried to go for stardom, it's been Speed 2, Cruise Control. So I'm not so surprised. I mean, Tom Cruise obviously has a very savvy producing partner and eye for what is going to sell. And I think that's sort of what differentiates his career. But anyway, talking about The Beast, which is also, incidentally, my good. It is, yeah, I agree with basically everything that's said so far. I think it's the thing that distinguishes it, I would say, from some other war movies is it's almost more of a little sort of one set play that just happens to move all over the place. The fact that it's a tank, you've got these characters who are constantly in this very enclosed situation, and it's about the various tensions and switching loyalties between Jason Patrick's sort of anti-authoritarian intellectual type and George Zunza's more than a bit insane commander.
You want to talk to a great movie villain?
Yeah.
But he's basically the only character in that movie that is one note. Most of them have like different beats and go through changes.
But that one note, man, he's got the volume cranked.
Yeah, he's amazing.
That's one loud ass note.
And I like that they introduced the women too, which feature pretty.
Yeah, the role of the women who are sort of the survivors of the initial village attack and against the wishes of the avenging group of men, they sort of go off on their own and look for revenge. And they end up popping up at some opportune or inopportune times, depending on who you're talking about, and sort of add a little bit of a twist of irony to some of the characters' fates, I guess.
Especially when you know the Islam's view on women generally.
Mm-hmm. And well, I think something that deserves mentioning is, you know, the fact that it opens with that attack right away. It's challenging you to sort of figure out who you're supposed to root for. Because we're following the tank, but you know, we're introduced to them sort of committing this atrocity, and you know, within the group driving the tank, the Russians, it's by no means sort of one unit who are all operating in harmony. There's a number of sort of rifts between the different people in the tank. And so you get some very interesting interplay between the characters, both, you know, just within the Afghanistan group and within the Russian tank group. And then as the group sort of break up and people get switched one way or the other, you get some interesting back and forth. So it definitely keeps you engaged.
I had no idea, man. That was Manny from Scarface played the con.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I actually laughed when he came in because just the idea of him playing this, I guess he's inherits the leader role in the village.
It's his brother at the beginning, isn't it? Gets
run over by
rolled
the
over by the tank.
Yeah.
And also to see Stephen Quinn actually give a good performance—that's a rare thing.
I
leave McManus alone, for God's sake.
No. Do not leave him alone. He is an open target these days.
He might show up on another episode of Fear Factor now. Great. We've made him relevant again.
Well, he's got the entire Christian right sort of trying to get him back in the public eye because he lost everything. But then he accepted Jesus. Go, Stephen Baldwin.
Well played, Stephen Baldwin. Well played. How about you, John?
I'm good. You know, what else is there to say, man? I've been a huge fan of it since I was 9 years old. I got to go with Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves.
Ba-ba-ba!
Yeah, when a movie is that good that it's that a film studio chooses its score as their own official theme song.
Mm-hmm. But that's a great theme too.
Yeah,
dude, that's Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. Just it's one of those movies. I know there's a lot of people out there complaining about, you know, the Costner performance. I thought it was great.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and He was a big star at the time, man. And that's I really think, you know, that move, a lot of that movie's success is linked to just how big his name was.
Well, he was at that point in time, he was the biggest man in Hollywood. You know, he could make or break a production at that point, right?
Yeah. And you got this. I just thought it was an absolutely fantastic movie. You know, larger than life characters, just great adventure story. Anyone who's going to go, I know there's a lot of people got a lot of nostalgia for the old Errol Adventures Flynn. Of Robin Hood, for Errol Flynn movie from the 30s. But you know, if you're going to tell me that the 91 one is any less of a rollicking adventure film, you're insane.
Yeah, that is true. I mean, you know, like
it's a great movie.
Not
the thing that
away
that bothers
Curtis.
Me. Is, well, I just want to say, you know, like people like to. I love the Errol Flynn movie in its own right. But you know, people say, you know, oh, Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, Kevin Costner trying to do that accent. But it's, you know, it's all about Errol Flynn. It's like, well, watch that movie. Like, half of the people have Brooklyn accents. Like, aside from the fact that Kevin Costner can't do an English accent.
Your Majesty.
Go back
Give
and
me
watch
back my mutton joint.
Go back and watch Spartacus. I love you, Spartacus.
I have read the classics. the Prince of Thieves, I think, people sort of like zero in on not only Costner's accent, but sort of the fact that there's been a bit of a turn and, you know, people laugh about the postman and various things. But if it wasn't for that, I think people would be a lot kinder to it these days. And I would agree with John.
They were certainly calling when they were lining up around the block buying movie tickets for
it. Oh, yeah, for sure.
Well, it was the number two movie that year behind Terminator 2.
Yeah.
You know.
The only movie that could top it was Terminator 2.
Yeah.
Was the most expensive movie of all time at that point in time.
But, even like for every scene, you know, any problem you might have with Costner's performance in it, in whatever scene he's in, he's got somebody there standing next to him that's just absolutely amazing, right? The guy spends the entire movie sharing the camera with Morgan Freeman's best performance. And if it's not Morgan Freeman's
best performance, I would also go so far as to say that
it's the spittle shooting out of Alan Rickman's mouth.
Yeah, people tend to confuse the accent with the performance. You know, Kevin Costner he has a tendency to be a little one note, but aside from the fact that he couldn't pull off the English accent, he's really good in this.
He's just an affable dude, man. He's just, you want to have a beer with Kevin Costner.
I don't know if it's because I can't tell the difference, but I didn't even hear that he was trying to do the accent. Except that maybe some little points, but what's his face? Jeez, I have a mind block. Heather's
Christian
young
Slater.
Kid.
Christian Slater.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you hear Slater's attempt at an English accent and realize that if Costner had tried to put that over his natural, like, Southern California desert bomb accent.
I actually hear Costner trying to do an accent.
There is one line. There is one line that's still there where he totally does the English accent. And it's not even terrible, but I just think it would have distracted his performance in the rest of the film. It's a training montage, and or it's before the training montage when Costner stands up on the, you know, on the little log and he's giving his speech and stuff, and one of the characters shouts out, you know, "Oh, but they got armor!" And Costner's like, "Yeah, but even this boy can be taught to find the chinks in any armor." You know?
There's also Azim, I am home.
Yeah, Azim the Great One.
But I usually have, like, movies like I've playing in the background of my house when I'm drawing or doing any graphics work or anything. And whenever he says that Azim line, if I'm not looking at the screen, I got to think for a second if I'm watching Point Break. Gee, whoa.
And if we are going to mention performances, we have to mention Alan Rickman.
We do. Alan Rickman definitely has to get props for that one.
You know, I came to Prince of Thieves, I was 10 years old, I think, when it came out, 9 or 10. It was one of the first movies I really went to see in a theater. I didn't see a lot of movies as a young child in theater. My dad took me to Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. And so this was before I was exposed to Hans Gruber. So for me, in a lot of ways, The Sheriff of Nottingham is like the iconic Rickman performance. This movie is always going to be a favorite of mine. I didn't put it as my good. Now I kind of wish I had.
Well, I will remedy that.
We forgot to mention Michael Wincott.
Oh man.
Oh my god. Why a spoon, cousin?
didn't we gushed enough about Wincott?
You can't use
already.
A spoon, cousin, because it is lodged in my throat.
Loxley.
Might I have the pleasure of your name before I run you through?
He just spits.
John, this time he really jumped at me.
He just.
One of these days he's going to cough up that hairball, but until then.
I hope he finishes recording Darksiders 2 before he does it.
My good, I it was hard for me because I really love The Beast. That movie is a phenomenal piece of work. But in the end, my heart went out over my head, and I had to go with Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. I Man, that movie is just, it was something that when I saw it opening night in theater. There was about five or six of us. I can't even tell you how old we were because my maths are horrible tonight. But
58.
I was 58. No, I wasn't 58.
Woolridge was 58.
I was 85. No, I wasn't 85 either. Wait. No, but it was, it's one of those movies that it was there in theater. I mean, we saw it in theater twice, I believe, because it was one of those, you know, it was midsummer or whatever. And hey, we're bored. Let's go see a movie. What's playing that we want to see? Well, we've seen everything. Oh, let's just go see Robin Hood again. Okay. You know, that kind of thing. And I did see it again later, late in the summer, or might have been early fall. It was the last movie I saw at our local drive-in theater before it blew down. We had it was a double feature of Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, and The Rocketeer.
Oh, that's great.
It was awesome. It was absolutely at a drive-in. You know, you can't top that. You can't beat that, right? It's the old.
I just want to point out that there are so many good actors in this movie.
Yeah.
That we've talked about acting and we've forgotten about Brian Blessed.
Like, I'm Brian Blessed.
Oh, yeah, it's like, I just like to think, you know, they brought Brian Blessed on late in the production, showed him the dailies of Alan Rickman, and he's like, damn it, I'll show that man how to ham.
He says, in this movie, he says the greatest you when the sheriff is unmasked.
You!
You!
God!
Die!
Oh, man. And like, what you were saying, Andrew, about Rickman, I mean, I had seen Die Hard before I saw Prince of Thieves, and when I saw the trailers, it's like, crap, that's the guy, that's the awesome bad guy from Die Hard. And I thought he was better in Robin Hood. I really did. I thought it was a better performance. I thought it was more, just, it was Rickman, really. Like, I mean, Gruber, yeah, I mean, I do credit Rickman with creating that character to a point. But, you know, McTiernan definitely had something to do with it as well. Like, McTiernan is the kind of hands-on director who, you know, he wasn't going to just let Rickman run with it. You know, he definitely had a lot of input there. But you see the sheriff, and that's just, that's Rickman cranked to 11. You know, that is all Rickman. And I know
he actually manages at a couple of points in this movie, I think, to extend a G. Like, he extends, like, hard consonants. Like, close the gate!
Hit the gate! But it's, no, Robin Hood, man, and for all of the ire, I guess, that it's picked up, because, I mean, it is a mainstream movie. It is a Hollywood, you know, full of bluster,
but,
and...
But so was, you know, Adventures of Robin Hood.
It was, it was.
Every bit.
And, well, it's so much fun. I hadn't seen it in many, many years. It's a movie that I've seen a lot when I was a kid, and it's... I mean, you're still drawn by it, and it's still fun, and there's nothing that points out at you that says, oh, this movie was made in 1990-whatever.
Yeah.
Christian Slater's haircut.
Yeah, besides that.
Christian Slater's eye swoop.
Excuse me, Christian Slater.
I wore my hair like that from 1989 to a couple years ago when I got married, and... You insult me, sir.
Harumph.
Yeah, no, it's on the top of his head.
And I mean, and one of the things about it, you know, you look at it, and we're talking about, you know, we're talking about Costner, we're talking about Rickman, we're talking about Morgan Freeman, Brian Blessed, you know, Michael Wincott, but Reynolds' direction was just so solid. Like, the action sequences and stuff in this movie were so high energy. You know, mm-hmm. I always
and
go back
it's
to...
It's a bit dated now, but there's a, like, people remember that arrow shot.
Yeah.
That arrow splitting, following the arrow through the trees.
Yep.
Like, at the time, that was a brilliant bit of crazy, like, just visual candy.
Yeah, and that slow-mo when it, like, the bunny shot, the one that was, you know, at the end of all the trailers and stuff, where he launches the flaming arrow in slow motion. And yeah. It was just, man, it was... Every action sequence was...
It was movie magic.
Yeah, it was an entirely captivating flick. You know, it had just... The action beats were fantastically well done, well-paced, well-choreographed. You know, it was the last of the really, like, the high action...
Why am I not watching this right now?
I keep...
And then there's that unforgettable Adam Smith song.
Oh, well, I mean...
Listen, guys... let's not forget that we're all Canadians. We can't insult our godfather of soul.
Well, I mean, if
blue-eyed, pockmarked soul.
I can't wait for Dan Mancini and Mitch Hathaway to hear this podcast, because they'll know that Brian Adams had to come up at some point.
Brian Adams' face, Adams' face looks like Michael Wincott's voice. I always say that whenever I'm driving, I hit like a really shitty bit of highway. You know, this road is worse than Brian Adams' face.
I mean, I'm not normally one to expound on this sort of details. I usually keep this kind of stuff to myself, but I made out with a girl in the back of a Jeep to that song, so I will never complain about it. And that's all.
Look into my eyes.
I made out with Brian Adams in the back of the Smoother than you'd think.
I stared at the back window of a Jeep at a guy making out with Brian Adams to that song. That
was you! And ended the night early, John. She was too creeped out.
You've been sending those Polaroids in the mail.
But no, it's just, man, it's a fun, fun movie. And just a textbook, you know, for action directing. It's a great action flick. It's just so well-paced, so well put together. And
I would say rousing.
Yeah, every action beat is just so energetic.
I would say that without regret or irony.
But no, it's just, it's one of maybe three or four movies that, no matter how shitty I'm feeling, it never fails to cheer me up. You know, like it's my perfect night is, you know, a night on the couch with Sarah and a blanket and Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, because we'll both be feeling A-okay afterwards. You know, no matter how shitty our day was, it's that kind of a movie. Moving on to our bads, our flawed but still enjoyable, or otherwise, you know. People think they suck, but we really enjoy them. And I got a feeling we probably all picked the same movie for this one, but I could be mistaken. We'll go in reverse order. I'll start with me, I guess. Yeah, because I went last, didn't I? Yeah, here we go. That's how good my memory is tonight.
Somebody likes his own voice.
Okay, you know what? Forget it. Gabriel, you go first.
I picked Fandango, his first movie.
Oh, you didn't pick what I thought everybody was going to pick.
Which, I mean, it's an enjoyable coming-of-age movie about a guy finishing college and going on that last road trip. It's very episodic, too much for its own good, I feel, and it feels a lot like a first movie. I mean, it's good, but still, the you can see that the director is going. There's a lot of quirks, like that who drives the airplane, who's too like this major hippie, like smoking joints while flying the plane, and he's very active. He's just very quirky and like, oh, I'm going to make this cool character and everybody's going to love him. He feels out of place in the movie, I feel.
He's the Bob Fett of the movie.
But there's some very interesting stuff, like Costner when he was young. Judd Nelson, not playing like a badass, playing the coward guy. And there's, my favorite scene in the movie is, they're shooting fireworks in a cemetery and the light changes and it's night and it's like Vietnam. Mm-hmm. I love that scene. It's very reminiscent because one is leaving for the, to go to Vietnam, so he's linking that to their present day action.
Is it ironic that I forgot about Judd Nelson?
Not really. We always forget about Judd Nelson.
It's definitely a movie that's made by a young filmmaker who's still feeling out the territory.
Yeah, it almost feels like the episodic nature of it for me, it almost feels like that was more of a compromise. It was basically how he kind of had to shoot the film. I think it was just set up that, you know, the way locations worked out, the way actors worked out, the way scheduling worked out, it was basically the only way he could piece it together.
Oh, I forgot to mention something else that bothered me. Sorry, I keep thinking, but it bothered me that the the girl that marries the guy at the end was the girl that Costner was in love with. I know that's usual for, like, high school romances.
Yeah.
But I still felt that was a stupid ploy. But the way the wedding comes together at the end of the movie, that was great.
It definitely showed that, like, even early on, Reynolds had a really clean, really, you know, he had a good idea of style. He really framed scenes well. His compositions were really solid, you know. He was a good technical director right out of the gate, I think.
The way the movie begins, like, with the music and the shots of the car, I mean, that's pretty impressive.
Yeah. How about you, Andrew?
Well, mine is Rapa Nui.
Oh, you disappoint me too. Wow.
I was tempted to go for Robin Hood to push my devil's advocate skills to the limit. But the thing with Rapa Nui, again, we should clarify for maybe people who aren't familiar, bad doesn't necessarily mean we think it's really bad. It's those movies that we think are flawed, they lie sort of in that middle ground.
Not exemplary of the director's body of work.
No. I mean, Rapa Nui, I would say, is probably his straight-up, visually his best film. And I think that a lot of the weaknesses in it are in a similar way to, you know, some of the criticisms people have about Avatar. I think it's sort of a film where the director really wanted to make a story in a particular world, had a very strong visual idea of it, didn't want to clutter these visual ideas up with too complicated a story. And I think sort of where it falls down is that we end up with really, I mean, despite the very exotic setting of Easter Island before European discovery, it's really stock characters. I didn't really feel much for any of them. The female lead is in, like, you want to talk about thankless female roles. She is literally a prize to be won.
Yeah.
And she's actually put in a hole during the parts of the movies where we aren't supposed to bother thinking about her. So, like,
about that.
It is gorgeous. The scenery is fantastic, and obviously Reynolds had these really grand ideas for shots. You know, a lot of really amazing footage of them carving and raising those iconic Easter Island statues. There's a big sort of the main set piece of the movie is a race from the main island to one of the tiny off-lying islands. It's a competition to sort of determine who's going to be the leader. Also happens to be a competition to determine which of the childhood friends now on opposite sides of a conflict are going to win the hand of the girl who loves the protagonist. So, I mean, it's really got some really, really trite story elements and characters that I didn't really care about at all. But yeah, I got to give it props for just beautiful, beautiful cinematography. At the same time, I'm going to say.
It's been a while. Yeah, finish it. Sorry.
Okay. I was just going to say, at the same time, it's sort of, in terms of some of the really fantastic shots, I find it's got some of the most obvious points of references for one of Kevin Reynolds' weaknesses, which I think is inserting very sort of rich, complex, moving shots with the camera that reveals a lot of scenery, but that doesn't necessarily fit or serve a function in a scene.
Just like little interstitials.
And yeah, I mean, like, when they're sort of moving the statue, you know, he's following the feet, and it's like, okay, we're looking at the feet, we're seeing how heavy this thing is, but then the shot just, you know, the feet go by, the statue goes by, and then he just kind of cruises along the ground a bit and then pitches up and looks at a mountain. And it's like, yeah, that looked kind of cool, but why are we looking at the ground and then a mountain when we're in a scene about people moving a statue?
Fair enough.
So he gets a bit carried away, but I can forgive him. He's still on the Christmas list.
What I was going to ask is, I haven't had time to rewatch it. I saw it, I don't know, back in the VHS days, so a while ago. But isn't there some like adventure proportion to Ruppin? Pretty fun and exhilarating too.
I mean, it is. Yeah, it definitely sort of takes advantage of looking at a sort of lost exotic culture and you know, lots of running across rooftops and climbing and all kinds of crazy acrobatics and minor political intrigue and such. So, I mean, it has some fun elements, but it also kind of feels a little too serious that, given how slight the story is, it's kind of overly self-reverent. And you end up being like, well, you know, have a bit of fun.
I found it moved like a shot. You know, like it moved like a gunshot. It was really, really fast, I found. I'm not like, and I mean, yeah, some of the shots are a little meandering and stuff, but I just, for some reason, it felt like you blink and the movie's over. Maybe that's a sign of not a great deal of stuff happens in it. Like there's not a whole lot of plot or something, but it didn't seem to sit still for very long.
Maybe you fell asleep.
Maybe I did.
No, I mean, I didn't have quite that reaction, but yeah, I mean, it certainly doesn't drag.
Yeah. Yeah.
But
like, I mean, Robin Hood, I sit down and watch Robin Hood even, and now usually these days it's the director's cut because I think that's all that's on the Blu-ray is the extended cut. But Robin Hood feels like a lengthy movie. You know, it's kind of got that pseudo epic feel, but Rapa Nui felt really fast to me. And I mean, it's been probably 2 or 3 years since I've seen it last. So.
Mileage may vary.
Yeah, I did. It is a movie I did watch a fair bit, though. I know when it did come out on VHS, I picked it up on VHS back in the day. And I did watch it a fair bit. It was a movie that I watched, you know, on a pretty regular basis, mainly on the grounds that I remember when it was first released in theaters. It was, I think, one of the trailers, you know, from the director of Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. So I was like, oh, I'm going to have to check this out, you know?
I don't even think it cracked $1 million, though, at the box office.
Probably.
It was a major tank.
Yeah, I did actually see it in theater, right? And it was our cheap, crappy theater that it was in, too. But I did see it, I don't know if it was opening weekend or shortly thereafter in theater.
I remember as a video store sort of phenomenon.
Mm.
Maybe if Mel Gibson had shot it and it was all Easter Island speak, maybe then it would have cracked the box office.
Oh,
and it would have probably gotten a wider audience if it hadn't been rated R, which I think it probably only was because of all the National Geographic topless ladies.
Yeah, exactly. Running around. Exactly.
There's really nothing in it that a 13-year-old or 11-year-old, whatever, couldn't see.
And these days, I think it probably would only get a PG-13, you know?
Hmm. But there would be coconut bikinis.
Yes. How about you, John?
This one actually the hardest pick for me because I find Reynolds has a small but very, very solid filmography. I wanted to say Tristan and Isolde just for the fact that the movie couldn't hold my attention past 15 or 20 minutes.
See, I love Tristan and Isolde.
I'm sure I like it too. I'm sure I'll like it too when I can eventually get through it. But
same here.
this is one that, and like Andrew just said about, you know, bad does not denote it's a bad movie, because this is something that's very, very close to my heart. I got to go with just the exciting but very flawed Count of Monte Cristo. And Count of Monte Cristo, I saw in theaters. I lamentably never owned a copy of it on DVD. My sister owned one, so I never did bother picking one up. And then, you know, once I moved out in my own place, I completely forgot about it. And then eventually picked it up when it was released on Blu-ray. And it's Monte Cristo to me feels like it's a somewhat schizophrenic film.
Very much so.
Yeah, like you're getting, at some points Reynolds is going for what he had with Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, and at other points he's decided, you know, he's trying to make The Duelists.
Yeah, a gritty revenge movie.
Gritty revenge movie. Yeah. And then you also got to look at the fact that you're taking a 1,500-page epic, and he's like, on one hand, desperately trying to shave out what's not necessary, and I mean, there's a lot of Count Monte Cristo you can cut out to make a movie. You know, it's my favorite book. But I'll be the first guy to say, you know, it's, look at when it was written, it's long-winded.
There's a lot of
right?
way.
Yeah, there is a lot you can cut out to make a movie, but he's doing that with one hand, and at the other, he's using the other hand to throw whatever he can at the wall to see what's going to stick. And just like, you know, it... Again, it's a movie that move like constant forward momentum, but at no point in it do you ever really get any sense of danger for the characters or any sort of real emotional investment.
Mm-hmm.
You know? I think there's kind of a problem that I find with it is that Jim Caviezel I find to be a bit of a flat actor. I don't find he brings...
Man, like you're going to complain about Kevin Costner and Robin Hood. Look at the piece of balsa they had playing Edmond Dantes.
Yeah. And then I think Guy Pearce was trying to counteract that by I don't know, drinking rocket fuel and going crazy. Foaming at the nostrils.
Well, again, we did have Michael Wincott.
He is the greatest part of this movie.
He really is.
He takes that tiny character of the warden at this prison, and he just goes nuts with it.
Yeah.
In the greatest
way. Remember, Luis Guzman is pretty enjoyable, too, I think.
But it's just bizarre to see Luis Guzman.
in this movie in particular.
It's like Luis Guzman.
I didn't know what Luis Guzman was going for, man, because he plays the role as like a quasi-gay gangster. Right? And then you got I forget who the actor is, the one who played the pirate the smuggling captain that he hooked up with in the beginning. That guy's on screen for maybe 5 or 10 minutes, and he's awesome.
Mm.
Yeah, but it's just like you've got – whenever a character's come around, you get these flashes of brilliance from a lot of the ancillary characters, but they're not on screen long enough to really counteract just the dry Melba Toast performance from Caviezel.
Was it Freddie Jones played the captain?
No, it was actually. I believe it actually was a French or Italian actor.
Oh, okay.
Jamie Blanc.
I'm gonna look this up right now.
Was he Luigi Vampa?
Yes, he was.
Yeah, Jamie Blanc. I'll say it feels more like a conventional action picture than anything else Kevin Reynolds has done.
But I don't think Reynolds intended it to be a conventional action picture.
No, I honestly think, and this goes back to one of the bonus features actually on the Duelists DVD, which is an amazing bonus feature. But I think The Count of Monte Cristo and also Tristan and Isolde after that were really kind of very heavily influenced by the Duelists, by like Ridley's style on the Duelists in particular.
Reynolds was trying to evolve as what he'd been.
Yeah, and they were
but
also.
But at the same time, I think he was so concerned with, you know, the fact that he'd had a couple of high-profile misfires that he was trying to regain that Robin Hood.
Yeah.
And that's where a bit of that schizophrenic feel
comes in. Yeah, I mean, he definitely started to develop a more of a, like, kind of a dark and murky visual style after Waterworld and after Rapa Nui, like, with Count of Monte Cristo, with Tristan and Isolde. Like, there's a lot more, I guess, and I would assume...
187 was right between Waterworld and Count of Monte Cristo, and that was a major visual departure in a lot of ways.
Yeah, yeah, that's another prime example there. But I think, I don't know if it was changing a DPs or what, but he really seemed to be going for more of like a signature visual style, more in line with Ridley or Tony Scott, without Tony's hyperkinetic editing, you know, like really, I gotta say, like he must have... at that point in time, rediscovered the Duelists or something and kind of tried to nail that more painterly, early Ridley Scott / Stanley Kubrick painting with light.
And you remember when we were talking with Tony a few weeks ago, or a couple episodes ago?
Yeah.
Think about when we were talking about how he changed between Crimson Tide and Spy Game.
Yeah, yeah, same kind of deal. Yeah. Same kind of deal. There's definitely a tonal shift, you know?
Now, on the other hand, there are very, very few things in movies I enjoy more than Richard Harris.
Yeah, yeah.
And you want to talk about a man who was perfectly cast?
Yeah.
Yeah. His Abbé Faria is amazing.
And you can tell, too, man, he's relishing that. He is really... Oh, yeah. He's got his teeth sunk into that.
But you can't tell me that Richard Harris didn't read all the classics. Say it again, Andrew, because that was hilarious.
oh...
I read the classics. I can't do it anymore. Oh, God. That was an awful Tony Curtis.
It was a one-shot. It was a one-off.
Spartacus, I have read the classics. I have studied. I don't even know what the line is.
Richard Harris is a guy from, you know, Red Hook, Brooklyn, who could do a convincing English accent. Yeah. I can see Richard Harris with his Bedford Stuy Live or Die T-shirt.
My bad. I'm going to go with the one I really thought most of us were probably going to pick, and I'm going to say Waterworld.
What?
Yep.
You monster.
I
will set the taste out of your mouth.
I love Waterworld. I love that movie.
I almost picked it for my bad, but yeah.
It's not the unequivocal love that I can give to Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. Like, anybody tells me Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves sucks or is a bad movie, I tell them they're full of shit. I call them on it. I say, like, you know what? You don't know what you're talking about. You know, you're either colored by hatred of Kevin Costner or just the fact that there was a Bryan Adams pop song on the soundtrack. But either way, you know, if you can come to me and say that that Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves sucked, you obviously haven't seen it since 1991. You know, like, but Waterworld, I love Waterworld. I think Waterworld's a great movie. Waterworld is the road warrior on the ocean. And yeah. I mean, it looks,
but at the same time, it's the road warrior on the ocean.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, exactly. You know, it's, There's so much there that just feels kind of hackneyed, and I blame a lot of that on David Toohey's original script. Toohey was never a great writer. You know, The Arrival was not exactly.
Glad somebody said it.
Yeah, The Arrival was not brilliant. Pitch Black was definitely not brilliant.
Chronicles of Riddick is genius.
Yeah, okay. Chronicles of Riddick is a
piece of shit.
But you know, it's a lot of it. I think was just
at a time.
I think a lot of it was there in the original script, and I mean, I've heard the stories about Joss Whedon coming in to do rewrites and stuff like that, and, you know, like, it was a troubled production. It was a very troubled production, and I know that Reynolds and Costner butted heads on Prince of Thieves over the direction the picture was taken in editing. Like, Costner didn't like the fact that the Sheriff of Nottingham was kind of gobbling up the runtime, and people misrepresent that. People misinterpret that as Costner going on an ego trip, when what it was Costner trying to make a Robin Hood movie, not a Sheriff of Nottingham movie, you know? And with Waterworld, I mean, I thought Costner was brilliant in it, and I kind of passed on it in theater because I was in school at the time. I was doing graphic design at the time, and I was busy with school. I couldn't be bothered with it. And then when the word of mouth hit that it sucked and fish tar and, you know, all of this stuff, I just
heard that name in a long time.
Like,
I have rarely had as much fun in a theater than I did when I was 12 years old and I saw Waterworld.
And this is the thing. I sat down in January when it came out on video. I rented it. I was home crippled with a sinus infection. And I had grabbed 3 or 4 of the movies that I had missed over the summer. Like, I'd grabbed Die Hard with a Vengeance. I can't remember. There were 2 or 3 other VHS tapes I went out and I rented. It was all stuff. I was homesick.
Spike Lee's Clockers.
No.
Or no, it was Crooklyn that year.
I don't know, John. Stop. Why? Why would you even go there?
Apollo 13, That Thing You Do.
But no, I rented a few movies.
Mortal Kombat. Oh, it was Operation Dumbo Drop.
Rented a few movies, sat down, watched Die Hard, and thought, wow, this would have made a great sequel to The Last Boy Scout. Then I popped in Waterworld, and you know, I popped the tape in, and it was kind of like, wow, I can't wait for this to suck. And as soon as that opening score hit, I was like, man, this is freaking cool. And then when Costner kind of starts interacting.
It opens with Don LaFontaine.
when Costner starts interacting with people, and I was like, wow, he's really playing a bastard in this movie.
Yeah, the way he treats that kid.
Oh, man. Like, he throws him both overboard, and I was invested then. And then, of course, Dennis Hopper.
There's only one law on the open sea, okay? Costner's law.
Costner's law. But then you get Dennis Hopper, who was just, you know, chewing scenery like a mad, starved maniac in this movie. I have to wonder if Reynolds and Costner paid him an uncut coke like Coppola did on Apocalypse Now. You know?
It also has a great but small Kim Coates performance.
It does. It has a fantastic Kim Coates performance. I was just going to mention that too, man. Paper. And I love when he was on Strombolopolis or Snuffleupagus a few weeks ago. George actually played that clip from Walker. which was great. And, you know, like, it seemed like a movie that, you know, a lot of the trouble was kind of behind the scenes. A lot of the trouble, like, I don't think it's fair to say that it was, you know, it was infighting and stuff like that. It was such a big, massive project to wrangle. And I don't think Reynolds was up to the challenge of really reining it in like he could, like he should have when he was making it. And then, of course, you had Costner, who had a very specific vision for it, and he was also a producer. So, you know, it's just, that's it. That's
the, I choose to blame all the problems on Jack Black in the role of pilot.
The role of skyboat captain.
As far as I can remember, that's maybe the first movie I saw where, like, the word of mouth reading it was than the actual movie, you know? Like, people were wishing it to suck.
Yeah.
It was definitely, in the same way that Titanic, I think people wanted Titanic to fail, but Titanic managed to sort of go off and become this phenomenon.
But
Waterworld suffered the fate that people wanted it to.
But the way people were talking about Waterworld is almost the way people were talking about Geely.
Yeah, exactly. And it was on...
Unlike Wild Wild West, it didn't deserve it.
No, it really didn't. And
this was all... A lot of that was before anyone had seen a minute of film.
Yeah, exactly.
And this was before the internet, too. Before, like, forums went crazy and...
Yeah, well, I mean, I did have the internet at the time, and I know early movie sites like Dark Horizons, there was a lot of bad talk there. There was a lot of really bad speak going on, you know, but
well, people love to jump on, you know, the guy who's getting beaten up, unfortunately.
Yeah, exactly. And Costner hadn't exactly been, you know, Mr. Congeniality in Hollywood. The whole Tombstone Wyatt Earp debacle kind of lowered his street cred a little bit and stuff, you know, but
and there was definitely among the critical community, you know, I think people were really looking for any excuse to punish him for beating Goodfellas.
Yeah.
Best picture.
Yeah, for sure. And it's one of those movies, man. Like, now you talk to people, and it's only the people who've seen it who generally enjoy it. The small, extreme minority of people who saw it back in the day and hated it. And then there's everybody who hasn't seen it, but we're like, oh, yeah, Waterworld. You know, like, that negative connotation has kind of gone away, except for this small, extreme minority. You know, and it's entered the same kind of a cult area now that movies like, you know, like as horrible as it was, the David Lynch Dune or Crawl.
Hey, we will not speak ill of Dune.
Or Willow.
Or even Last Temptation of Christ.
Yeah. You know, like it's one of those movies that people who have seen it now for the vast majority, like, are fans of the movie. And I mean, I was always a fan. I was always there. Like I said, Mad Max on water. I'm down. You know, the costumes were just so amazing. The performances were great. The world that it took place in, it felt like there was, you know, there was a bit of substance there. It wasn't just, hey, what if we all got on a bunch of boats and shot at each other? You know,
imagine if water everywhere.
Yeah, exactly.
I remember when I saw it, all the pulleys and the devices that they were using reminded me of City of Lost Children.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
I like that it starts with him pissing and then drinking his own piss.
You don't drink into a Mr. Coffee and get Taster's Choice. But no, Waterworld is definitely my choice. I still enjoy the movie. And the extended cut is actually a really damn good little sci-fi epic. You know?
Mm-hmm. Now, I can't remember. You remember the slime bag? I think the character was the Nord. The smaller spy?
Oh, the right hand. Yeah. He was
what a
Hopper's
jerk.
Kind of fall guy.
Yeah.
That was...
I know he played the corrupt judge in Batman Begins.
Yeah. Oh, what was his name?
Interesting.
I can't remember his name.
That was a major douche right there.
Yeah, he was great too.
I kept hoping, you know, Costner was going to do that awesome thing at the beginning where he snapped the guy's mask in half, only he'd caught this guy in half.
he
and
was
his boat
cool.
was awesome.
Oh, the Tremoran. The three-hulled ship.
Mm-hmm.
We'll move on to our ugly. Our choice for just generally, you know, wow, what were they thinking? This just went so wrong. This is just such a mess of a film. You know, we'll go in the same order. Gabriel, we'll start with you.
Well, it's really hard for me to pick because I really liked all the movies I saw by Reynolds. I can't really call it, this would also be my bad. I can't call it an ugly because it's still good. It's just worse than Fandango. that's all I'd say. It's 187, the Samuel Jackson movie about inner city violence. It's
AKA pretty... Dangerous Minds 2.
No, I... See, I would defend that accusation because, I mean, it's not about, like, this white teacher coming to redeem the guys from the projects and, like, bring the class together through hard work. It's a very unusual... It's like... It's not the traditional inspiring teacher movie where someone... people climb on their desks and say, oh, okay, captain, my captain...
So it's a director. It's direct-to-video colors.
Yeah, more like that. But yeah, I mean, as I said, it's pretty interesting. It's a nice character study. It's very atmospheric. Some good camera. There's some shots, like in Rapa Nui, that Andrew mentioned, with shots that don't fit. There's a dream sequence near the end, which is really weird. And the end just plain the ending just plain sucks.
It really does.
I won't spoil it for people who haven't seen it, but it totally sucks.
It just deflates the rest of the movie, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Not even the little shocker bits, man. Just how it drones on for another few minutes after that, and it just 187 it collapses in on top of itself.
Yeah, yeah, it kind of does.
But that's the problem Crypt, I'd say. There's a lot of beats that don't really work in the movie, but that all seems to come from the script and not from Reynolds himself.
How about you, Andrew?
Mine? Well, I mean, again, I have to say, I don't think there's really a lot of ugly in Reynolds' filmography. But... I would say there are a few moments of dull. And so my ugly ends up being Tristan and Isolde, which I just thought was pretty uninspired by the numbers, feeling kind of, I don't want to say historical epic because it definitely doesn't feel epic.
No.
And it basically, you know, I am not a fan of Romeo and Juliet. I love my Shakespeare. There's a lot good in Romeo and Juliet. But man, could I not care any less about two photogenic young people pining for each other. the movie feels like, you know, the sort of most contrived. Well, I mean, it's kind of hard to go too hard on it because obviously they're sort of dealing in mythic terms. You know, it's not supposed to be overly complex, but. You know, it's basically two people who fall in love because they're both pretty, and then they mope around a lot. And then some people stab each other.
Is it the Twilight, basically?
What's that?
Is it Twilight?
I don't want to say that.
No, okay? It's nowhere near
that's
that.
That's unfair. I mean, I definitely... James Franco... just really irritated me in the role. He was whiny and then there was nothing to ingratiate him to me.
But you get Rufus Sewell like smacking him down.
Rufus Sewell is great. He also has one of the great voices. I can't do him as well as I can do my Michael Wincott, but I could probably do him better than I can do Tony Curtis.
Please do. was this movie before or after Rufus Sewell had his lazy eye fixed?
This was after, I believe.
Okay, because I always found that really distracting.
I always really liked it. But yeah, Rufus Sewell's cool. I mean, it's basically just sort of competent, but in a really uninteresting way to me. That's what I felt. It felt like, yes, it was hitting all its beats, but I've seen this a million times before. Nothing about, you know, who's good and who's bad is remotely surprising. I know what the conflict's going to be. Yes, I know they're going to be found out, and then people are going to be mad at them, and blah, blah, blah. Nah. I can't even muster enough energy to even trash this thing.
I like Tristan and Isolde. I did. I don't know. I've only seen it once.
And that's fine. Definitely just didn't connect with me at all.
I think a part of it with me with that movie though was I was expecting something really, really terrible.
Mm-hmm.
And a bit of interesting trivia on this one. Tristan and Isolde, the screenplay that Reynolds actually directed, was supposed to be Ridley Scott's first feature film.
I heard that, yeah.
Which was kind of neat. It was kind of cool to see it. And I guess part of it, I was kind of familiar with it because of that. I had read Scott's biography a few years ago and had tracked down a copy of the screenplay and stuff. So it was kind of, you know, because I'm a Scott fan, what can I say? But,
no.
But it was one of those movies that I really did. I expected it to suck. I saw the first trailer and I was like, wow, this looks like a big bag of shit. And I saw that Kevin Reynolds was directing it. And I was like, okay, Kevin Reynolds and swords. I can probably get behind this.
Turns out it's a small bag of shit.
Yeah. Well, I sat down. I watched it on video. I watched it on DVD. And I enjoyed it. I mean, it was myself and Sarah sat down and watched it, and it was a good, you know, it was a decent couples night movie. Yeah,
you were tricked by feminine wiles.
Maybe I was, but I'm a bit of a romantic anyway, so I did enjoy it. You know, I thought it was a pretty effective little telling of the whole Romeo and Juliet tale.
I like a good romance, but yeah, again, it comes down to it feels like I've seen it 100 times before, and I didn't feel like the characters' situations and all the conflicts in their lives were drawn quite well, but in terms of their individual personalities, I really didn't feel a lot of depth.
I can dig it. How about you, John?
Ugly? 111187.
Really?
Yeah. Dude, I couldn't get into it.
No?
I couldn't have cared less. That movie is one thing that's... It's Samuel L. Jackson, and that's it. You know, it's just...
No love for Clifton Collins?
Definitely no love for Clifton Collins.
Aw, man.
It's just, you know, it sits there idling for the entire runtime until an ending that seemed just engineered to send everyone home feeling like shit.
I called it the American History X ending. It was just designed to beat the viewer over the head to really shock them, you know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, I found that weird, John, because as much as I didn't like it, I still found it gripping and even, like, thrilling at times, like, wondering if Garfield really killed those people. And there's some tension you can keep, and the tension between the gangs and the teacher.
Personally, I think they should have merged the movie with what was that Tom Berenger one about the substitute teacher?
The substitute.
Yeah. Now, if Samuel L. Jackson had been the substitute, highest grossing movie of all time.
I too am also going to pick 187. Not because I really dislike the movie, because I don't. I just really hate that ending.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing. The first time I watched American History X, it was the same kind of deal, you know? Everybody was spooging themselves over how brilliant American History X was. And, of course, I was of the age where I was in college, I believe, when American History X came out, and hanging in a few film circles and stuff like that. And, oh, it's brilliant, yadder, 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 chatter, 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 you know, the pretentious, you know, wine-sniffing, beret-wearing, ascot-wearing... stereotypical college movie snob, you know?
Hey, shut up!
And I sat down and watched American History X, and I was with it right up until the final 5 minutes, man. And that ending hit, and I was like, that was the biggest, shittiest cop-out I've ever seen in my life. And 187, I had the exact same response to it. Now, I mean, until that point, I wasn't as quite on board as I was with American History X, but they both kind of give me similar vibes for different reasons. You know, like the both movies kind of feel cut from the same cloth. Like they're trying to say something really profound about, you know, racism and inner city relations and all this kind of stuff. And then they completely cap out on their message with a really trite, really shacky ending that's just designed to make you cluck your tongue. You know, it's just, I feel
like
so...
if 187 would have finished after that last gunshot, it would have.
Would have been a much better movie, yeah. Would have been a much, much better movie. And if it had been a...
Cut the credits, roll Tupac.
Yeah. a little more ambiguity would have been nice. You know, maybe don't spell it out so much in the final act. Don't really...
Yeah.
You know, leave it up in the air a little bit more. Leave the debate still kind of raging, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean...
You know what kind of amazes me? If you want to look at the difference that presumably that 3 years made... the budget for 187 and the budget for Rapa Nui, according to IMDb, are exactly the same.
Doesn't surprise me.
Yeah.
I'd say they were both pretty low.
You see a lot more money in Rapa Nui, though.
Yeah.
Oh, definitely, definitely. And I mean, 187 was pretty much all location shooting. It was pretty much all just, you know, offices and buildings and whatnot.
Yeah. It certainly doesn't have the level of spectacle.
No, definitely not.
How much of that money went to pay Samuel Jackson's paycheck?
I think probably it was sort of the prime of his, you know, like everybody was a Sam Jackson fan.
Was that after Pulp Fiction?
Yeah.
Yes, it was.
Yeah. It was a few years after.
Yeah, that's right. That was like 97 or something, wasn't it?
Yeah.
97 or 98.
His legend was building.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? Before he sold out to every single movie that got offered to him.
Oh, like Chris Walken.
And now no one cares about him anymore. So, to sum up, Gabe, give us some thoughts. Just some general thoughts on Kevin Reynolds as a director.
Well, as we said throughout the show, he's a very strong visual director with an interesting eye, especially for, I'd say, different cultures and the difference between the cultures that are there. There's a certain grimy feelings and real feelings. I'd say of his movies, an interest in nature too, a very dynamic way of shooting action and a great eye. But maybe he could use more character development. Most of the time, instead of relying on his visuals.
How about you, Gabriel or Andrew?
I'd agree with that. I mean, I think he's, you know, he's got a lot of polish. I think he's driven visually primarily. But again, you know, I felt bad choosing Tristan and Isolde as an ugly because I don't think he really has an ugly movie, but I also don't think he's a great director. I think he's a Richard Donner, you know? Richard Donner has Superman, which I love. And Kevin Reynolds has Robin Hood, which I love. But I don't think they are technically proficient directors who don't have, I think, a really strong personal voice. Fair I wouldn't enough. Analyze them with the auteur theory.
How about you, Mr. Mercer?
I pretty much kind of agree with what you guys said. I said it earlier when we were prepping. I said it during the episode itself.
Say it again.
I'm going to. You stop interrupting me. God.
Just on edge after Steve made fun of my beret.
Sure. Reynolds only has a small filmography, but I don't think he's out and out made, you know, a real disaster despite, you know, Waterworld being such a huge bomb. And I don't think he's made anything that I can really consider crap.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he also was responsible, directed one of my absolute favorite go-to movies.
Mm-hmm. You know, I feel like I was a bit hard on him because, you know, as much as I like to, you know, they're big directors that I would want to say a lot about. I kind of thought like Kevin Reynolds was so slight, I wasn't going to have anything to say. But, you know, talking about his movies has been some of the most fun I've had so far doing this podcast. Like, he makes fun movies.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with that.
I've got an anecdote, and it might not seem relevant at first. When I was in high school, we were reading Hemingway. And I had White Fang, you know, Jack London's White Fang, just in my book bag. I had been reading White Fang at the time. And my English teacher at the time, he's one of these, you know, these old school, he's one of these, you know, Robin Williams and Dead Poets Society style English teachers, you know, really, really into it, right? And he came over and he saw the book and he's, oh, look at that, Jack London, Hemingway light, you know? And I look at Reynolds in much the same fashion, you know. Reynolds is the Jack London of the filmmaking world. You know, he really does that. He's at one with nature. He's at one, like a lot of outdoors kind of, you know, like he's a man who loves to work outdoors, and it shows. And his movies have this really organic, this really, you know, you're in the moment, you're in the environment kind of feel to him that I really like. And he's a really solid director, you know, and he's never relied on a whole lot of trickery or a whole lot of, you know, gimmicks or camera sneakiness or anything. He's always just, he's kind of shot it the old fashioned way, but done it in a really accomplished fashion, you know, like he's really done just solid go-to work. I consider him, you know, just in terms of sheer technicality, one of the better directors on the go. In his prime, like in the early to mid 90s, but I think
if he got handed a few more solid scripts,
he needed his own Dances with Wolves, is what he needed, you know. And I mean, and from what I understand, from what I've been told, he actually had a lot more to do with Dances with Wolves than he's given any credit for. He was kind of Costner's advisor on that movie, and you know, he's a guy who just he never had. I think his big weakness is developing scripts.
Yeah.
I think he kind of, you know, he gets a script, he does relatively few passes. I mean, you know, you get a guy like Ridley Scott or one of these other strong visual directors, you know, like these guys, they go through draft after draft after draft. And I think Reynolds might have, you know, like if he changed one or two things, that was it. But then it would cause problems when he's shooting. Things wouldn't be, you know, they didn't do as many passes as maybe they should have or as much planning as maybe they should have. And that kind of shows at times, like some of his stuff is a little loose. But I do think that he's an accomplished director. And I think it's kind of a drag that he didn't really get a big shot after Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. Like, it's kind of a drag that he didn't really get a movie where he was able to really assert himself on a set and have a good, well-polished screenplay and really crank out that masterpiece, you know?
Mm-hmm. I think it's worth noting that he's currently developing a TV miniseries, I think.
A three-part Western.
Hatfields and McCoys.
Hatfields and McCoys, which looks phenomenal.
Costner, Paxton, Behringer.
Powers Booth.
Yeah,
I was going to say that I feel that basically The Beast is probably really his masterpiece.
Yeah, if we have The Beast one. Feels like his most fully accomplished work, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's definitely and, most depth.
Yeah.
And what you said about him being one with Mitch or just think of it, I could use it. He's like Werner Herzog or Terrence Malick without the pretensions and doing mainstream movies, basically.
Very good analogy, actually, there. Like, definitely in line with those guys without, you know, that avant-garde art feeling.
If Malick wasn't trying to make... If he wasn't exploring theme, if he was just having fun...
Yeah, if he was just making a mainstream narrative
movie.
Herzog wasn't so German and weird.
But then we wouldn't love him.
Yeah.
He is, you know, for me, I love the guy. And I mean, just based on his director's commentaries and behind the scenes stuff I've seen with him, he seems like a really affable guy. He just seems like a really down to earth, level headed filmmaker, you know, like he's one of the rare, not so crazy people, you know, and not overly pretentious about his craft, you know.
Hard guy to hate.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Exactly.
Lord knows I try.
So I guess on that note, we'll ask John, who are we tackling next time?
I figured next time, guys, we've done a few weeks of, you know, strong visual directors and a lot of action and adventure movies. So we're going to shake things up a little bit, and we're going to examine the life and times of John Landis.
Should be a good one.
And one of the great Hollywood beards.
I can't see the difference between John Landis and John Milius.
About 100 pounds. Zing!
I
bought
the cigar.
Yeah. I want to know the story where John Landis and Francis Ford Coppola bought their beards.
On that note, be sure to tune in next time when we tackle John Landis. It's sure to be entertaining. Take care. We're out of here.
All right.